Hello and welcome to the Journey to a Dream podcast with me, Beth Espy. Thank you so much for downloading this episode. First of all, as ever, we're really grateful for the support of the Andreas Racing Association and also the Manx Motorcycle Club, which runs the MGP here on the Isle of Man. Now, in today's episode, we're going to be joined by one of the standout stories of the Manx Grand Prix, certainly from 2024, which was his newcomer year. Harley Rushton didn't just make an impression, he also won a race, and this year he also set a lap record. A man who truly lives and breathes bikes, but actually, when he's not chasing apexes around the mountain course, you might just find him behind the wheel of a coach or tucking into something sweet, because apparently he's got quite the sugar habit. Racing clearly runs in his family as well. His granddad got his ACU licence at the age of 65. There was so much to talk about. Here's Harley.
I'm from North Yorkshire, England, but live right over on the west side of North Yorkshire. So, like I said, I probably consider the Isle of Man to be one of my closest race circuits. Travel-wise, it only takes 45 minutes to get down to Heysham to get on the boat, and a couple of miles off the boat, and you're back in the race paddock. So it's mad to think about it like that. That four-hour boat journey probably makes it feel a little bit longer, but mileage-wise, it's one of my closest circuits, I've got to say.
Yeah, you just have like a little mini cruise over here, don't you?
Maybe when you're doing it like six times a year, it don't feel like a mini cruise, or when you're sat bobbing about out in Douglas Harbour and they go, oh yeah, we can't actually get into the harbour yet, but we'll give you a free breakfast.
So, first of all, before we sort of get into finding out a little bit more about you, Harley, why are you over here so much?
I do quite a lot of work bringing things over here for various people. Just my job sort of takes me logistically organising bits and pieces, so I'm quite often bringing bike parts over, bikes, machines, things like that. But predominantly, I just really enjoy coming to the island. I've been coming here since I was 7 years old. Pestered my dad for years and years and years. Mum was like, where do you want to go on holiday? Rattling off places like Tenerife, Salou. And I just kept saying to my dad, I want to go to the Isle of Man. I want to go to the Isle of Man. And eventually, he relented and brought me and my sister here in, I think it would be 2002, just after the foot and mouth year. So, yeah, ever since that, I've come at least once every year. And when I say at least, I mean at least once. So the more times I can come over, the better. And, so not just work, it's personal reasons. I like to come over here for a bit of a holiday. And with it being so easy and accessible for me from where I live to get down onto the boat, just going over as a foot passenger with a push bike. And, yeah, I really enjoy being over here, to be fair.
So, seven-year-old Harley then, desperate to come over to the Isle of Man. What was it about it that you remember at that point?
I think the main thing was my dad and granddad would disappear off TT week, and they'd come back with all these stories of the Isle of Man and the racing, and all I'd have was a VHS that my granddad had brought back to watch, and I was there. I was like, I want to be there watching that. So it was a draw of motorcycle racing. Like I said, my dad and granddad were massive into the bikes, and that's been my whole life. That's all I've really wanted to do. When I was a kid, I'd ride around on push bikes, scooters, and eventually motorbikes where we lived. And I never had an interest in kicking a football or throwing a ball about. It was always, if it had two wheels and I could create a bit of a racetrack and ride round and round and round in circles, that was me entertained. So wanting to come on holiday somewhere where there was bikes racing around on the roads was a massive thing for me to come and watch.
So obviously your dad and granddad interested in it. Did either of them race at all?
Yeah, my granddad probably holds a record for being the oldest man in the UK to get his ACU race licence at the age of 65. There's, of all things, people say you have senior moments. That's got to be one of the most senior moments I've ever known. But before that, he raced grass track and do like motorcycle hill climbing. He actually used to race go-karts at like British level back when Nigel Mansell was coming up through the ranks. He always tells a story, I beat Nigel Mansell one day at Heysham Head Karting Track that's now sadly fallen in the sea. But yeah, he was massive into his motorsport, and my dad the same. He did hill climbing, he started racing, and he actually, my dad raced at the Manx Grand Prix in 2007, and that was our family holiday for 2 weeks. He dragged me and my sister, caravan, van, bikes, all the spares over to the Isle of Man. And that was us stationed in the paddock for 2 weeks. Absolutely loved it and never forgotten that holiday.
Amazing. Obviously, you mentioned Nigel Mansell used to live over here as well. So you've got all the connections there. And just, I'm just intrigued to know what it's like for a little boy who has been watching that VHS and seeing it that way to suddenly be standing on part of the course. I don't know if you can remember where you were and how that felt when you saw the bikes going past for the first time.
I remember it vividly, and I think my sister does because you probably can't do it now. It was actually the little kink at the end of Sulby Strait. Me and my dad got us stationed there. There's a bench just at the side of the road. So he sat us on the bench. But before any of the bikes came round, and he looked us both dead in the eye and he said, "I don't want either of you to take your attention off any of them bikes coming." He said, "If any of them look like they're out of control," he said, "this is your escape route, back over the banking." And we were like, right, okay. So we sat there for the whole night of practice, eyes glued on every single machine that came down Sulby Strait that night. And I don't think either me or my sister will ever forget that.
And do you think at that moment you can say a dream was formed, that one day you thought you wanted to do it yourself?
I think the imagination of a dream was formed there, but I never actually had any belief in myself that I was ever going to compete in any sort of racing over in the Isle of Man. It was mainly just a passion for coming and watching it at that point. And I saw everyone who was doing it as a bit of a hero of mine, to be honest. So at that stage, I never really cemented it as a realistic dream in my head. It was always maybe sort of a fictitious dream and something that I would sort of want to happen, but I had no idea how I was going to make it happen at that point.
What were you like at school then?
I couldn't wait to leave. It was I didn't want to go to school, and from the moment I got there, I couldn't wait to get away from school. Like I said, the school sort of general sports weren't my bag. Playing football, I never played rugby, I never understood the rules of that. Cricket was a bit too slow paced. I just couldn't wait to get home off the school bus and get out on my push bike and go round and round in circles. Living in the middle of nowhere, though, my poor sister got dragged in. I made her race me round the tracks that I'd spent hours and hours making. And, yeah, she always lost. But that was I don't know if that was my inner competitiveness coming out or the fact that I was racing a girl that was a year younger than myself.
Does she still do any racing now? Did you instill that little dream in her?
No, I think I crushed every possibility of her ever ending up doing any racing. She's had a go on motorbikes and bits and pieces, but she's never actually wanted to do it herself. I think she fell out with two wheels. She was like, four wheels is more for me.
And so then when you are growing up and particularly not loving school, which so many people don't, did you have many friends who were into the same sort of things as you?
Yeah, thankfully. By the time I got to high school, there was I had some friends, and one of my friends, he raced motocross, and another couple of lads, they lived on farms. So everyone had like motorbikes around the farms, quad bikes and things. We were all really into anything with an engine, to be honest. And our typical Saturday would be, we'd all ride our bikes down into the local village and we'd just go and build jumps and ride around all afternoon until got the phone call on the Nokia 5610 brick phone off my dad saying he's coming to pick me up.
At what point then do you think your family realised that you were taking this a little bit more seriously?
Well, it was the pestering, the constant pestering. The first thing was, I want to go and watch the Isle of Man. The second thing was, I was going to race meetings with my dad. And I got to the age of 12, 13, and I said, I want to do this. And he never wanted to be that pushy parent. So it was the fact that I was showing willing and I was in the workshop helping him fix and spanner his bikes and, well, when I say fix, I was passing him spanners and help, observing, asking questions. But I think he saw that I had a vested interest. So he took me and did my ASU race licence and got me that at age 13. And unlike most kids in an evening, I would spend probably very limited time on the PlayStation. Parents probably beg to differ. But I'd like to think I was out in the workshop sort of helping my dad because he bought me the first race bike. But he said, I'm not working on it all week for you to just turn up and ride it. He says, you have to come and show your interest. And I did, to be fair, because that's all I wanted to do. In my head, I wanted to go and race motorbikes, and I put everything I could into it at the time. And I don't think anyone, apart from me, one or two friends that did race bikes, no one at school really knew what I was doing because they had no idea what motorcycle racing was. And I was just going about it as a bit of a maverick on my own. And when I said I'm going away racing for the weekend, people had no idea what sort of racing I was doing.
So I guess not much of a typical teenager then in terms of sort of going out and partying and drinking and all that sort of stuff.
No, there wasn't any of that. I mean, living in the middle of the Yorkshire Dales didn't really help with that factor either, where your closest neighbours are a field full of sheep. You're not really going to do much partying with them. I remember vividly one week my sports teacher said, "Oh, can you come and play for the school football team on Friday night? So we're a player down." And he really must have been clutching at straws to ask me because my hand-eye coordination's terrible and football was more likely to end up in the river than in a goal. But I said, no, I'm busy, I'm away racing. And he said, racing what? And I explained to him. I said, oh, motorbikes, like on tarmac tracks. And he looked me dead in the eye and said, you shouldn't be doing that. That's too dangerous. You need to come and play football. That's a lot safer. And I think at that point, that was me fully rebelling against conforming to going and playing what the school PE teachers wanted me to do. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to go motorbike racing now.
It is dangerous, though, obviously. Were your parents ever worried about that side of things?
Yeah, my mum was massively. Bless her. I think it was only two or three years ago she came and actually watched me race for the first time. She would never, ever come and watch me race. She didn't want to see any pictures, any videos. All she wanted to know was that I was safe at the end of the day. But I think she saw the passion that I had for it and she knew that she couldn't stop me from doing that. And she has been now to watch me race and she is probably my biggest fan and supporter. When I was racing at the Isle of Man over the last two, three years, she listens to every single minute of Manx Radio and every little bit of commentary that's going on. She's there at the other end of the radio listening to it, even if she's not here, which I'm probably glad that she isn't because I think she'd be ultimately scared.
And I guess that's difficult for you as well, isn't it? Because before a race, you just want to be worrying about, I guess, getting yourself in the best possible frame of mind and just planning for what's coming ahead. So to have to deal with people around you who are quite anxious, yeah, would be quite difficult. And do you get worried and nervous before a race? How do you handle it?
I think my worried and nervousness is I go really quiet and sharp with people rather than being made usual joyous sort of laughy self. I maybe pull a little bit of a joke or something, but people probably notice around me that I just go quiet and go into my own little zone. The full concentration comes down. And the people I have around me, like my sister's really, really calm and relaxed. She's been with me the whole way through, and she always just knows how to sort of hold herself around me to keep me as relaxed as possible. And everyone else who comes with me, my friend Luke, my friend Tom, had a new mechanic this year, Ollie, they sort of learnt how to cope with me over a weekend. And then my right-hand lady, Fiona, she makes sure I keep drinking and eating. And basically, if she wasn't there making sure I drank and ate, I'd be talking and concentrating on bikes too much that I'd be dehydrated and wouldn't have the fuel in me to go racing, never mind be relaxed enough.
Yeah, I suppose that's something that we probably don't think about. It's not just about sitting on the bike, is it? It's about that whole preparation and making sure that you can get through a race, however many laps it is. So to have those people who really get you and understand how you work in that moment must be really, yeah, really important.
Yeah, I feel like the last couple of years has been a massive eye-opener, particularly coming and racing over in the Isle of Man. The strain on the body and like the physical demands you put yourself through. I've always tried to stay fit myself, but I came to the Isle of Man in 2024 and I realised that my body was not cut out for the punishment of racing the mountain course. Been 6'2", although this year I got measured and I was 6'1½, so I said the Isle of Man shrunk me by all the bumps getting smashed to pieces around here. But yeah, my lanky frame isn't really designed to be crushed up and folded onto a motorcycle, so I put myself at a disadvantage there. But the physical demand's really hard, and I try more so than ever to put myself in the best position before I get on the bike and head out onto the track to be as sort of physically ready for it all as possible, and having the right people around you, making sure you've got the new nutritional side right before you get going. Because it's all right having a bike that's absolutely mint, people put all this effort into it, but if you're not physically right to ride it, you're not giving that bike 100%.
How much of your day in percentage terms do you think you spend thinking about bikes?
This time of year, probably very, very little. I go into winter, and after the mad summer where you've spent 7 or 8 months just thinking about motorbikes all the time, I'd sort of forget about them a bit. It's cold and wet outside, and I don't really want to ride around on motorbikes, to be quite honest. I'm a dry-weather rider. But, yeah, even now, to be honest, even saying that, I still think about motorbikes. I'm thinking about next year, what I'm wanting to do, what we can do to start moving things forward. It never ever leaves your mind. You might think it does for a day or two, but then all of a sudden these little thoughts come in. You see something like that triggers a thought and go, oh yeah, I'm gonna have to go and get that sorted ahead of next year. Or even like now coming up, it's a month away and we're gonna have to start renewing our race licenses again, and it's all of a sudden 12 months since that was done. So it is a year-round thing, although I do like to try and take winter out and just put bikes on the back burner a little bit.
I guess it's amazing to think about all the paperwork then that's involved in this.
Yeah, I say I need someone to do my own admin, to be fair. I finish work and end up feeling like I'm busier than ever doing sort of personal admin to get licenses done, making sure that I've ordered parts and paid the right people, kept on top of all my bills, entered the race meetings, and then I'm also coming over to Isle of Man. You've got ferry bookings to do as well, and then you decide to bring a caravan over, you need a caravan permit. It's all the little pieces that you try to link it all together. Just the Manx Grand Prix this year, I got so many people to come and help me because I realised I needed the support. But I was being the logistics organiser and coordinator for all of them. They said, oh, I'm coming with this van and that's the reg. And then I had to sort everything else out. So they were at the docks, like, ringing me at 6 a.m. after I'd been out practicing the night before, saying, oh, the ferry's cancelled, what do I do? And I'm like, so I'm ringing up the steam packet trying to figure out what's happening. So, yeah, there's so much goes on behind the scenes, but it's just you do everything to get them people there because in the moment when you're ready to go out on track, they're the people you need round and you need as much support as possible.
You mentioned work. What is it you do?
Oh, you haven't got long enough on this podcast for me to describe what I do as a job. It's a mixture of a lot of different things. I like to consider myself sort of a freelance motorsport mechanic and logistics coordinator. I've worked for the past 3 years in British Superbikes as Glenn Irwin's and more recently Scott Redding's tyre technician at PBM. But I also drive the race trucks with all the equipment into the circuits and help set the garage up and all that side of things. And yeah, when the Superbike season's not on, I'm either driving trucks round home, delivering cement, gravel, soil, whatever, or go to the totally other end of the spectrum. I also work for a local coach company, so I'll take people on day trips out to the seaside or kids on school trips to Christmas markets and all that side of things and all the paperwork and health and safety in between. So my job's quite broad. and that's just sort of like glossing over the surface of things that I do.
That's amazing. When you're driving the coach, do you get the little microphone that you can talk to the people and tell them where they're going?
Yeah, you do, to be fair. It's I sometimes try and think that I'm like a pilot in a plane saying your emergency exits are here, here and here, and the toilet is located in the middle down the steps. Everyone always asks me questions about the coach driving. I try and gloss over that as a small thing, and that's what everyone picks up on.
Oh, I just think it's
the image. I'm surprised you haven't asked about tips yet, from Yorkshire and tight.
Obviously, that was going to be my next question, clearly. But I love the fact that you're employment is so varied, and I wonder what that says about you. I mean, we've already talked about the fact you didn't really like school very much, you know, that idea of maybe being pigeonholed and having to do one particular thing, whereas it sounds like you are the sort of person who enjoys having lots of different challenges and manages to juggle it all somehow.
Yeah, I mean, my mum says she can't even keep up with my life. She calls for a catch-up every 2 or 3 days to see where I've been in the world, not just the country, the world. Where I've been, what I've been doing, and who I've been working for at the time. I think a lot of people say they like routine. I'm definitely a person I don't like routine. I've worked in the same place for 3 years, and the routine side of things killed me. I like the fact that tomorrow morning I could be up at 3 a.m, then the day after it could be like a leisurely start at 9 o'clock or something like that. I just like a lot of variety, and I think that means that every week goes a lot quicker because it's not, you're not doing the same thing day in, day out. And I'm a big believer that if you enjoy going to work, it's not like a strenuous job. I think I'd slog it out day in, day out. If you enjoy your work, it's not really work.
I wonder what little Harley would have made of the fact you working with things like Superbike and things like that. I mean, that must have been something that I suppose he could have only dreamt about doing.
Yeah, to be fair, it was when I started working for Paul Bird Motorsport, Paul got me signed up himself, and that was like a dream come true, really, to be fair. As a sort of 12-year-old Harley, well, probably even younger, it'd be sort of 8-year-old. My dad took me to Croft to go and watch Superbikes, and like, I've got the Paul Bird Motorsport T-shirt, and I was like, I want to work for that team. So when I was there in the 2023 season that was, everyone remembers British Superbike 23 season had been a little bit controversial, and I was slap bang in the middle of all the controversy. And I'd still, at the time, I think I should have really pinched myself and realised what I was a part of. It wasn't until after all the dust had settled I'd realised that I'd been quite a crucial part in what had gone on through that season, with people asking me day in, day out, going, what's going on? Who's slagging who off? What's the tension like in team? And I was just like, I don't really want to talk about work now. Can we just sort of like sit and talk about normal lad stuff in the pub?
You wouldn't know how to talk about normal lads, so it's all coaches, isn't it? And you know, when
you've
been
in your... Yeah, that's it, yeah. Talking about coaches and trucks and how much power they've got. And...
But I guess, again, just from the point of view of racing, knowing how it all works from all angles, I guess, must be really helpful for you as a rider, because you understand everybody's part to play and you understand, I suppose, the pressures that sometimes other people in your team must be under.
Yeah, I've seen racing from every other aspect. It's quite good in a way, because I understand, obviously I'm nowhere near the level of British Superbike riders, but working in that paddock, I can see the strain and stress that they're under. And I feel like I know sometimes a bit better than others in the team when to just give a rider a bit of space and not ask that stupid question, because we've all been hot-headed. I've come in from a race and someone's come and asked me a question and I could have like just flipped and like gone, what on earth are you asking me that for right at this moment? So I feel like it's really high emotions all the time in motorsport and any sort of sport. So I can see when a rider comes in from the track and they're wanting to just get their head clear before you ask them a stupid question. Now, you know, when to give people a little bit of space. And the same thing from the riding side of things. You know, when a rider's asking certain things, I'm like, they really want that. And that, it doesn't matter if you think they need that. You give them that for that little bit of self-confidence, because then that triggers something in the head to say, all right, that's been done. And they might push that nth level. The change or setup change you made to the bike, or the half a PSI you took out of the front tyre, might have made no difference. But in the head, it's made 0.2 a lap. And being a rider, I know that can be a massive thing. If you go, that tyre needs a little bit of pressure out of it, even if it's not physically going to make any difference to the setup of the bike, as a rider, you know, right, that's taking a bit of pressure out. You might just have literally altered your riding style from the session before to the next one, but in your head you're like, it's the PSI we took out of that tyre. So I look at it from all aspects and realise that, yeah, everyone is only human at the end of the day. And yeah, we're working with machines, and squiggly lines on screens can say so much and tell a lot about what's going on with the bike. But I think a lot of it is down to that human aspect and everyone being happy in the team. And when that rider throws his leg over the bike, he needs to know that is 100%. Particularly having ridden one down Braille, I need to have the trust in the people who've put the bike together to know that it's going to be absolutely spot on for that next 37¾ miles.
Take us back then to the time when you decided that you were going to put your entry in for the MGP, because it was only your newcomer last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, 2024 was my newcomer year. So my racing career, it was had a few ups and downs. Whether you want me to go through that or not.
No, go on. Give us an overview.
So I started racing 125s because the Formula 125, like Super Team bike, was the cheapest way to go. So I did that for 2 or 3 seasons. I won the World 100 Championship with that. But unfortunately, at age 14, I got quite serious illness with appendicitis. And I was off school for 6 months and basically out of action for a good 12 months. So my racing took a massive backseat then. By the time I was coming back fighting fit when I was like 16 year old again, I was far too tall for a one. Too heavy because I'd built all my strength back up by eating a load, and far too tall to race a 125. So it's like that's a crucial period in time, really, when you're progressing in your racing career. So I feel like I missed quite a big boat there in the modern bike racing world. And we were doing it all on a shoestring, me and my dad. We were just doing what racing we could afford, to be honest. So I had no direction at that point, but thankfully Ted Wolf from Craven Classic Racing, probably more famously known over here for Jamie Coward and Dean Harrison riding his classic Manx Nortons to great success at the Classic TT. He threw me a lifeline. He lives locally to me, 10-15 minutes away, and he gave me a test day on one of his classic bikes. So I took it with both arms, and I always give everything 110%. And I must have impressed that day, because 12 years later, I'm still riding classic bikes for him. But it was a way for me, the classic bike thing was a way for me to go racing competitively at a relatively low cost. I just had to pay tyres, fuel, entry, and a bit of diesel in Ted's race truck. But it got me at the forefront of like the top level of classic racing in the UK. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to afford any of the bikes I was racing, to be honest. So that got me foot in the door, and I did that for many years. Didn't really take off into doing any modern bike racing for nearly a decade, to be honest. And then a couple of opportunities with Ted came up to race down at Billowen at the pre-TT, but I think it was 2017 he asked me, and at that point in my life I didn't feel I was ready to go road racing, so I politely declined. I'm like, I'm not going to rush into going and racing on the roads, even though it's something I've always had a passion for and always watched. I knew from what everyone had said it was something you seriously need to consider, and you can't go road racing unless you're 100% confident that's what you want to do. So I gave it a miss, and then COVID came round, and probably with everything going on with COVID in 2020, I went, oh, let's go and race at Oliver's Mount. So as with most people from North Yorkshire, my first road race was at Oliver's Mount. It was my only actual race meeting that year, and I absolutely loved it. Like, little park track, racing between the trees. There was a few scary moments in the damp, but it was like, I came back and I was like, oh, well, I think one of my mates summed it up brilliantly. I walked into the pub on the Monday night when I got back from Oliver's Mount, and he goes, well, we better have a drink to the fact that you've come back alive. And I went, that's a bit dark, isn't it, really? But in my head, I was like, I never had any doubt. I was like, I was confident in my ability. I never even thought about the dangers that could have been at that point. And I feel like the road racing thing really progressed from there. I decided I will go and race down at Blowen at the pre-TT. It was 2023. I went there as a newcomer, got top newcomer on the classic bikes. And then from there into the winter of 23 into 24, I thought, right, now's the time. I want to go and race at the Manx Grand Prix. I feel like I'm in a good place in my racing career. I felt confident in my own ability, so I put that entry in for the Manx Grand Prix and see if I got a confirmation back, to be honest.
I tell you, speaking to people who are in that position at this point as we're talking now, Harley, that waiting must just be excruciating, because you can't really plan, I guess, the next season until you know exactly what you're doing.
No, I mean, the time I actually put an entry in, I didn't actually have any bikes to ride. I put an entry in for the... You're only, as a newcomer, allowed to enter two classes. So I put an entry in for the Senior Classic and the Junior Classic race. I'd voiced my interest to Ted that I wanted to go and race at the Isle of Man. Unfortunately, he already had Jamie Coward on board and Dean Harrison. And I'm not at the level to take bikes off people like that. So I just voiced my interest, said I'd really like to go there. And would Ted help me try and get some bikes? He said, yeah, we'll see how it goes. But it is down to waiting if you get that confirmation back. But in my head, I thought, I'm going to put it in. It'll either come back with a yes or a no. I wasn't like, either way, if it came back no, I thought, that's someone telling me that I'm still not ready to go and race in the Isle of Man. But anyway, it came back yes. And probably around about the same time, that's when Chris Hughes came on board, which is the classic bikes that I race over here in the Isle of Man. And I'd worked closely with him a couple of years previously. He'd helped me out quite a bit, mainly with the two-stroke side of things, on like setting the carburation up and just teaching me a little bit how to ride them, particularly that first road race I did at Oliver's Mount. He really helped me through mere hairpin, just to get through the hairpin and out up the hill, which I was like, I entrust what his bikes are prepared like, and I thought they're really good bikes on a similar level to the ones I was riding for Ted. So when he rang me in January 2024 and said, I'm interested in going to the Isle of Man with you, all came about the same time I got my entry confirmed. I was like, right, it's getting real now. This is going to happen. So, yeah, everything sort of spiralled out of control from there.
What do you remember about that time that you arrived on the island knowing that you were going to be taking on the mountain course for the first time?
It was quite sort of surreal. We did all the newcomers weekends, as everyone did. And I actually missed the final newcomers weekend. But the first time I came, I must have impressed Milky enough with my work ethic and whatever else, because I said, oh, I'm sorry, I can't make it that one. He said, don't worry. He said, what you did on the first newcomers weekend, he said, he's more in trust me that you're competent to take on the mountain course. And I was like, no, I didn't realise that. I don't know if it was the attention to detail I paid the first newcomers weekend or the 17-page Word document of course notes that I had. Having never been very good at school, the amount of paperwork I put into coming and racing the mountain course was unreal. So the first time coming over here was actually, I was on my own on the ferry coming over. It was a late night boat. I wanted to get over before the team and everyone else. I came over with a massive kit bag to come and get set up on the island, do all the scrutineering with all my riding gear and everything else. So it was quite surreal, on the boat, on your own, turning up on the island, literally on your own, to take on the mountain course. That was probably my first experience of arriving here.
Wow. I can't even imagine when it's something that you've wanted to do for obviously quite a long time. And it sounds like you were so sensible about it, just waiting until you were in that position where you felt it was the right thing to do. So you go through all the setting up and whatever. We know the weather wasn't brilliant in 2024.
I mean, the setting up nearly broke us as a family, to be fair. Me and my sister had a little bit of a fallout. I think she had to go and have an afternoon, like, gin or something at one point, because I was like, tensions were high. I'm like, this, everything needs to be 100%, and she's like, I'll help you with everything. And I was like, throwing demands that were probably a little bit above and beyond what she really should have been doing. I did try telling her, I said it's gonna be more full on than you've ever experienced before for both of us. And yeah, it pushed everyone to breaking point, I think, that first year.
Yeah, well, I guess you're really tired as well. You won't be sleeping properly, will you? Because there's all that anticipation and whatever.
No, there'd been a lot of sort of 2-3 in the mornings leading up to it, getting the bikes ready, even back in England, just in the workshop, getting the bikes ready before we loaded everything up to come over here. So yeah, sleepless nights, and you never sleep properly because you're constantly thinking about it, particularly before that first run out onto the mountain course. You're so apprehensive. I did have him in the back of my head. I said to myself, I'm going to see how it goes the first time out. And I said to people who were close to me, I said, if it's not for me, I've still got to pack it up. I said, I'm still in that mind frame that if it doesn't click or I just don't feel it's the right thing to do, I'll come back in and I'll sit and watch the event for the next 2 weeks. I was fully prepared to do that. So I was still a bit nervous. I didn't know how I was going to find it, to be honest.
So you had that first outing. You're behind, obviously, more experienced riders at that point.
Yeah.
What do you remember?
I probably had the best sort of surreal experience as my first outing. My newcomer lap was behind John McGuinness. So the same guy that I remember coming in 2007 to watch him do the first 130-mile-an-hour lap. So for him to be taking me out around the mountain course, and by that point, I sort of knew John quite well. So he gave me a few good pointers before he went out. And the last thing he said to me, he said, whatever you do when we go out on this lap, don't follow my rear wheel, look past me. He said, because following my rear wheel, you'll never know if you know the track or not. So I took that on board and we went out, and it's a very, very sedate ride round just to familiarise yourself where the track goes. But I think the confident, inspiring thing then was I never got lost. I know you're following someone, but I knew what was coming up before it came up. So in my head, I'm like, I've done the homework. I know where I'm going. So I came back in and I was like, that was great. I'm like, I'm ready to go again. So then you get like, I think you get like an hour of reprieve or something, and then you head out for the first time on your own, which I think that first time you head out on your own, I came in and said, it's just, yeah, I was like, that shouldn't be allowed. You shouldn't be allowed to go and do that. It's the fact that people let you go and do it. It's just, yeah, it's unbelievable.
And having been prepared to park the bike up and just watch, if it hadn't been for you, was there any question at all in your mind?
No, from that first lap on my own, like I said, I knew it. I knew I'd put the effort in. I'd done the typical thing. I'd played the PlayStation game lap after lap after lap. Again, watching videos, your mind can wander. So at least if you're playing the PlayStation game, if your mind wanders, the rider crashes. So you've got, I thought that was a really good way to keep on top of learning the track. I'd had my course notes, and I'd put my earphones in at work while I was driving coach or something. I'd have all my own notes playing through my head. So
you could have read it out to them.
I could have done, yeah. I could have read it out on the tannoy. I mean, I have done that before in the coach. I think probably it'd be the 2011 something TT. I think I had playing out through the coach speakers because we're on the way back on a school run while the senior race was on. So whether everyone wanted to listen to it or not, they'd have no choice, to be honest.
I love that. So anyway, yeah, so you knew that you were absolutely ready. You'd done all your homework, and then it's just getting as many laps in as possible, which, as I say, we know because of the weather was difficult. And that must just place another strain on what is already a stressful time.
Yeah, it was. Well, I don't know if it was. I did the first lap because we got the first day of practicing really out of the way in 2024, and that was all right. And I was happy. I knew where the track went. So it was a case of I had to learn where the bumps were, really. That's the only thing you can't learn until you're actually going around the course at speed. So I knew I could just build and build on it, but we went into 3 days of no practice, which was quite good for us because all the stress of setting everything up, we weren't fully set up yet. So we had time to finish setting the awning up and finish like putting sponsor decals on the bikes and little bits and pieces that have taken a bit of a back burner. So I think the 3 days of no practice were quite good. Well, the first day and a half were good. Maybe the second day and a half we were like tapping our feet in the paddock, itching to get out at that point. But it was hard. The whole thing was a difficult time. I figured out I got 7, maybe 8 laps in the whole event in 2024. So it was tough for everyone. I can't really complain. But I think I've been coming to the Isle of Man long enough. Everyone kept saying to me, said, are you not really, really, like, pissed off? Like, stood round, not doing anything. I went, just looked and went, it's the Isle of Man. I said, it is what it is. I said, you can't get grumpy or angry around here. I said, the weather will do what the weather will do.
Can't get grumpy and angry unless you're putting up an awning or a tent.
Yeah, if you're trying to do that in the wind and rain, yeah, I can understand and get really frustrated. That's when you potentially go, right, we're going into a bed and breakfast tonight. That's enough.
And what we know now, Harley, is that 2024, race-wise, was fairly good for you. You did incredibly well. I mean, I don't know whether you had an idea in your mind about what you wanted to achieve or whether you were literally just of the mindset that, actually, I'm just going to go there and see how it goes.
Yeah, I came with a mindset. I think, say, a bucket list thing's the wrong way to go about it, because anything I do, I want to do 100%. I wasn't going to come here and just ride round as an also ran rider. But I came in my mindset the first year, I just want to come and complete a race. I want to get one of them little replicas. That was like a big thing. My dad came in 2007. He didn't even finish a race. So in my head, that was a big bucket list thing to come here and just complete a race. And the elements were against us in 24, and the races were reduced and shortened. And I only actually ended up having one bike to race in the end. So before I set off, I said, I'm just going to treat this as a practice lap. So off we went, got my head down. No pit boards, nothing. So I just rode my own race and rode as fast as I felt like I could comfortably. And came across the line, literally no idea where I'd finished. And coming up the return road, there's loads of people like clapping and cheering and like putting the fingers up in the air. And I'd still no idea at this point, because it was like a split race. They had the standard winner's enclosure, but because we were in the junior classic race, they took us up to some garages at the end of pit lane, and I pulled into there, and it was the moment that I think it was Ed Wilson like gave me the number one and pointed me into the garage, and I'm still really confused. It wasn't until my sister run up behind me and she said, you did it, boy, you did it. And I said, I did what? And she said, you won the race. And I went, really? I said, how on earth have we done that? And she was like absolutely in tears. She's like, everything we've done, you've achieved. This is what we've come here to do. And I'm like, I was just like taken back. And then it was just a swarm of people coming and congratulating me at that point. And it definitely didn't set in at that point. And it didn't set in for another 2 or 3 months, to be honest, what we'd actually achieved.
10 seconds to go. That is now 5 seconds in 5, 4, 3. Listen to the noise of the pattern. And the lieutenant governor of the Isle of Man sets John McGuinness off, and he goes to the speed trap of the grandstand at 34.5. Well, here we go. We've got a race on here. And the first of the junior bikes on corrected time slots into 11th place for Mikey Evans. Let's get to Ramsey. Rob Pritchard.
Yeah, before the first machine arrives, second has arrived at Glen Helen in the Classic Junior number 16. Glen English in a 6.05.4 compared to Mikey Evans' 5 minutes 37.4 here. First two machines in the Classic Junior class are at Balaf. Number 22, Nigel Moore, 10 minutes 0.8.1. Harley Rushton, 10 minutes 10.5. And number 16, Glen English, 10 minutes 19.3.
Yeah, it's definitely hotting up, Rob. Thank you. At the Bungalow, 2.365 from Sean Anderson to John McGuinness, and then it's, well, 8 seconds back to Adam McLean, but the 350s are keeping a little eye on that leaderboard as well. We know they are in the junior there, the junior classic 350s. Who's leading that? Chris Boyd.
Well, Mikey Evans was leading at Glen Helen. He doesn't seem to have made Balaf, so Nigel Moore is the leading 350 now by only 2.4 seconds from newcomer Harley Rushton, both on Hondas. Jonathan Perry in third, only 1.9 seconds down, so there's no more than 4 seconds separating the top three.
More riders continuing to cross the line, and keep a little eye on the 350s. Chris Boyd, what have we got there, my friend?
Ramsey, newcomer Harley Rushton has taken the lead on the Honda 350 by 14.7 seconds over Nigel Moore, with Glenn English in third, and then Mark Johnson, Chris Moore and David Glover rounding out the top six. But it's changed again at the Bungalow, because Nigel Moore does not appear to have made the Bungalow, so Harley Rushton's lead over Glenn English now goes out to nearly 32 seconds, with Mark Johnson, the third of the three 350 machines to have made the Bungalow.
Chris Boyd, you're just pointing some out to me there,
yeah,
quickly.
Top two are through Cronk Namona of the 350s. Harley Rushton leads now by 43.2 seconds over Glen English. So we'll have them here in a minute or so.
As we look at once more, this him. Could be him. Across the line, there he goes. 48, Harley Rushton across the line. Chris Boyd, and there we'll get his lap time in a minute, unless you have it straight to hand, sir, do you?
Hope so, yes. We have it at it's 23 minutes 11.4, 97.615. And Glen English crosses the line in second, 24 minutes exactly, 0.3. So it's a 48.8 second victory for Harley Rushton, a newcomer victory at the Manx Grand Prix.
The winner of the 350 class, the Classic Junior, Harley Rushton, is with Beth.
Harley, how was that?
Unbelievable, really, to come here as a newcomer, the first time ever been here at the event, and I had no pit signals and nothing round the course. It was, yeah, unbelievable. Chris Hughes has built this bike from the ground up, and we've had a really, really hard month getting here and getting everything ready. My dad and granddad are sat down at Braddon Bridge cheering me on, so they'll be over the moon with this result. And massive thanks to my sister Kelly. She's worked tirelessly, not just this week, but all through my racing career to get me here.
And Carolyn, you worked so hard with the newcomers, and I could see your little proud face as well. Yes, yeah, it was so good to do that. But that's a really good lap time that you did on the 350 as well. So.
Yeah, that's my fastest lap of the week, and it's just kept building and building for the toughest week ever for newcomers. But I've had a really good grounding riding for Ted Wolf and Craven Classic Racing for the past 10 years. They took me on and they brought me through and brought me riding on. I wouldn't have been able to come here without the support and dedication that Ted himself has put into me over the years, so I really appreciate that, as well as the hard work that Chris has put in to get the bike together. And he's not slept really this week, just making sure everything's spot on and the bike ran faultlessly out there. So massive thank you to all my supporters and my mum at home. She'll definitely be listening.
I remember being that little seven-year-old boy in the hedgerows watching the classic racing around the Isle of Man, going, like, you listen on the Manx radio presentation and, like, all the national anthems going off on the boat, and I'm like, oh, one day it'd be nice for that to be me. And then for it to happen on my first ever time on the mountain course, and just to see the raw emotion. And like I said, I wasn't riding Ted Wolf's bikes at the event, but just to see him, he'd been there as part of my journey, and he came over and congratulated me, and you could see that he knew that he'd been a part of all that. And it was overwhelming. It really was overwhelming. Even when I got home, I still didn't realise it setting. I think I probably tell a lot of people this story. The boat journey back was really strange, because it was like that night everyone left and went home. So I came back in my van the day after, and the crossings are all cancelled because of the weather. So I got off the boat at midnight, and I was set off the boat, and I went, well, what do I do now? Do I just go home, don't I? And like, it's like all the hype and like excitement's gone. And so on my way home, I actually thought, I don't really want to go home yet. So I pulled into McDonald's down in Lancaster near Heacham, sat there and just ordered a McDonald's meal on my own. Bearing in mind, I don't really like McDonald's. I don't know why I went and did this, but it was like a weird sign. I went and ordered my food, and I got the ticket through 001. And I went, that's a good sign. Yeah, you win a Manx Grand Prix, next thing you're just sat in McDonald's at 1 o'clock in the morning on your own eating food.
You know how to celebrate, don't you? That's amazing. Oh, it's got to become a little bit of a ritual, that though, hasn't it, Harley, I reckon? Yeah, I can't imagine when everything has just been so intense. I mean, was that one of the races that your mum actually did come over and watch?
No, she's still not actually been to watch me race in the Isle of Man. I asked her this year if she wanted to come, and she's like, she's still a little bit against it, I think. But yeah, she was listening on the radio, so she was there as number one fan, and I think she was on the phone to my sister straight away and congratulating everyone.
And your dad must have been absolutely beside himself.
Yeah, well, to be fair, it was my dad and granddad that got me into racing, and thankfully, my dad and granddad were both sat at Braddon Bridge at the church. So it must have been like proud father and grandfather moment, saying, that's our lad, that. But I can vividly remember my granddad's reaction. My granddad, if anyone knows him, he loves a chippy. So I obviously, after the race, the first time I saw him was at Porkjack Chippy. Went caught up with him and opened the door of the van, and my granddad looks me dead in the eyes, and he just looked at me in the most Yorkshire accent and went, did you enjoy that? That was it. Didn't say well done or anything. Did you enjoy that? And I went, yeah, I did, granddad. Thank you. And that's about as much recognition he's ever given me for it.
I love the fact that this theme of chips going through this story here as well. Yeah, it's brilliant. It obviously, though, when you've done so well in your first year, it does set the bar high, doesn't it? And when you're thinking about coming back for 2025, I wonder what that does to your sort of process of thinking, okay, what am I going to do this year?
I think the sensible thing would have been to have given up racing at that point. I'd achieved everything I ever wanted to in racing. Everything I'd worked towards, I'd achieved in that one moment. And I should really have gone home, hung my levers up and gone, yep, that's it. That's me retired now, going out on a high. But unfortunately, the Isle of Man sort of gets you. Yeah, I've been bitten by the bug, and I've probably been racing for that long. I've had winters off. I've had winters where I've been injured, and you go, oh, is it worthwhile? And it gets back round to like February, March time, and then you just end up wanting to go back racing. So the same for the Isle of Man. I should really have retired, but I thought I'm gonna go back. I want to return, and I'd feel like I didn't really get that much practice and track time in. I feel like we got a little bit done with the weather, so over winter I was like, yeah, we're gonna go back. So the same classic bikes I was obviously going back with, but this is where the shift came, and I wanted to go and have a bit of a ride on a modern bike, because I'd never done anything like that before. I'd had my own 600 track bike and done one track day on it. That was about it. So I started putting the feelers out, to be fair. I was at a little club meeting over near Scunthorpe in January of 2025, and I'd put an entry at this point for the Manx Grand Prix to race in the Super Twin race and the Junior, as well as the Classic races at the Classic TT. They'd be coming in 2025. And I'd just put the feelers out while I was doing a speech saying I really want to race a Super Twin, but I don't know how I'm going to go about it because I haven't got one. But if anyone knows anyone who could help out or anyone who'd like to come on board, and I said, I my ethic, I'm going to give everything 110%. So I literally just put the feelers out, and I didn't think anything was going to come back of it. But the next morning, I got a text message from a certain Nick Gledhill of All Speed Racing, and his mate Nick Anderson happened to be sat in the room. Probably had had about 7 or 8 pints at this point, and thought it'd be a good idea to try and link me up with Nick and All Speeds. And I got the message through the next morning, and I was a little bit shook, and I was like, wow. I'd also had Chris Moore had said, oh, he'd like to help me out, and he said we can try and make a bit of a plan. And he said, but he couldn't really confirm anything until he'd raced his bike at the TT himself. So that was going to be something that was going to have to linger on until we could actually make a plan. Whereas Nick Gledhill was like, look, I'm not racing this year. My wife's 40th birthday, so he's got to take a year out. And we were both newcomers in 2024, me and Nick, him on the modern bikes and me on the old classics. It basically just threw me a lifeline, and I took it with open arms. I said to my dad, I said, come on. I said, let's get in the car. We're going to Scarborough. He said, come and have a cup of tea and some biscuits, and we'll have a chat about potentially racing at the Manx on my Super Twin in 2025. So that was it. One morning, up early, over to Scarborough. I bought the biscuits, he made the tea. I'm quite partial to a few biscuits. I think I probably didn't eat as many as I normally would while we were having this discussion, because I didn't want him to see that I had quite a sweet tooth. But yeah, the meeting went from there, and went from strength to strength. We got along like house on fire, and I couldn't have worked with anyone better, to be honest. His work ethic is meticulous. He's got more OCD than I have. His bikes are absolutely pristine. And every time I threw my leg over him, I felt like it was like a work of art rather than a racing motorbike. And I knew the work he put into it. And I, all year, wanted to repay him with the results. So we went testing. Him and myself said, we're going to do this properly. We're going to go testing. We're going to do race meetings, get me up to speed with the bike, because it's something I've never ridden anything like that before. Everyone's like, what's it like? I'm like, it's like a big classic bike that goes when you want it to, stops when you want it to, and turns when you want it to. I said, it's great. So yeah, we went from there and did some track days and a few race meetings. And I think at the point Nick said, he said, you've started to own that bike. He said, every track we've been to, you've gone faster on it than I ever have. And he probably hate me for saying that, but he said you've made the bike yours. And I felt like we came into the Manx Grand Prix in a really, really strong position with that and the classics.
And in 2025, everybody who was doing sort of MGP and classic got more laps in, I think, than the whole of 2024 in the first couple of days alone, didn't they? The conditions for it were absolutely amazing. What was your overall assessment of how it went for you?
Well, the conditions were amazing, but day one didn't go amazingly for us. I did the first lap, felt really comfortable on the bike, going on to lap two, and I got black flagged at Douglas Road Corner just coming into Kirkmichael because the bike was smoking. So it was still running, and after a phone call back to Nick, he said, oh, just get it back to the paddock. So it's that surreal moment of riding a race bike back on the public roads, which
everyone has to do it.
Everyone
has
to do it at some point. Yeah, it was great. It's all right until you get someone in a Honda Jazz going incredibly slowly, and race bikes don't run at slow speeds. The spark plugs kept fluffing up, and I kept having to rev it. So I was going through like the middle of Douglas with the clutch in, revving it out, trying to clear the engine out. So I probably looked really antisocial. Apologies to any road users, I probably upset. But yeah, we got that back, and that, unfortunately, that was that engine gone. So that was our practice week engine. So the only thing to do, I'd done one lap on the bike at this point, and everyone else had done like at least four laps on that first day of practice because the weather was superb. So that was it. Next day, we put the spare engine in. That was us all practice week. We were in a rock and hard place, really, because we were down to, we were running the race engine at this point, but because I'd never ridden a bike of that speed around the mountain course, I'd only done seven laps around the course to start with. I needed to be up to speed. I needed to learn the track and the bike around the track. It was like, we didn't want to put too many miles on the engine, but it was a really difficult position. There's no point sitting there while the weather's nice and not been out learning the course. So we did, thankfully, Scott and Oliver Wilson, who Ollie was mechanicking for me, and his dad, they did lend us a spare engine just in case anything had gone wrong through practice week. Thankfully it didn't, but we knew going into race one, even we knew the engine was high on mileage. Nick Gledhill said to me, he said just give it everything it's got. As his daughter said, he said, you've got to go chicken rocker fast. Whatever that means, that was the motto we went with for Manx Grand Prix 2025.
I'm just going to write that down too.
Yeah, that's a good one. We try to get that in on the radio at nearly every interview, to be fair, because I knew she'd be listening with little Izzy. So we went into race one, and the only expectation, everyone else had their own expectations. My expectation in my own head was a top 10. I wanted a top 10, to be honest. I'd been seeded as a rider, which that blew my mind anyway. Having never ridden a modern bike, the fact that the Manx Grand Prix organisers had seeded me was a bit of a strange one, but I felt like someone must have some confidence in me. So in the race, I went out. The only pit board I had in that first race was my dad at the Craig. I put a plea out for people to help him, because people who don't know my dad, unfortunately, he suffers from MS. It's progressively getting a little bit worse. So he was a trooper. He soldiered this massive pit board that was like a blooming sail, to be honest, all the way to vantage point of the Craig. Some kind people helped him with it up onto the bank and everything. But that was my only reference of where I was in the race. So came round lap one, I think it said P12, and I was like, P12? I was chuntering to myself and angry. Came into the pits, and I had my pit crew was all my best mates. There was Luke, who's been my best mate since I was about 5 years old, and now he's my sister's husband. Mate Tommy, who I met while I was at university, and he's the one I entrusted to put fuel in the bike, because I knew that he'd be on top of the job. He refuels GT cars in World Endurance, so I thought he's more than capable. And then Ollie was there helping out to clean the screen and everything else and put the filler cap back on, and my sister there with a fire extinguisher in the world's tightest overalls that she said, I daren't move too much, otherwise I think they're going to split open. It was a good chuckle if you ever saw her walking through the paddock at the Manx Grand Prix this year. She couldn't move very well, let's put it that way. It was like that was like a reset, that pit stop anyway. So I then went out the pit stop, and before then, Kevin Canny, he passed me up on the mountain. He passed me just after the mountain mile, and I thought, he's made 10 seconds up on me. I said, I'm dawdling about here. I thought, that's it, race done. If someone's caught 10 seconds on you around here, that's race done. So he was ahead of me out the pits, and by the end of that second lap, I'd caught back up with him again. So then going on to the third lap, I must have overtaken him seven or eight times, like we were swapping places, but nothing to shy away from, that my bike was probably like 8 to 10 mile an hour down through the speed traps and everyone else. It potentially a mixture of my size, but I felt like I'd folded myself up onto the bike as much as I could. I mean, the physios do wonders over here. I've worked closely with Kath at Rex Physio, and Alex, she's really helped me from 24 to 25 make it so I'm more comfortable on the bike. So I feel like I'm fairly what tucked in, but the Kawasaki twins, they are a little bit slower in a straight line, so I was losing out a lot of speed on Canny. So that last lap, I'd pass him through the twisty bits, and then he'd come past me on the straights, and it was a bit more like club racing, to be honest. And every time I passed him, I'd put my hand up and apologise, because I felt like I was messing his race up a bit, and he was like no, you weren't at all. So that last lap, it was changing positions. I found it was the most dangerous thing I'd done, was ride close to someone round the Isle of Man. It's not the done thing. So going into the end of the lap, I'd dropped back maybe 5 or 10 bike lengths and just gave myself a bit of space. I'm like, right, we're just going to get to the end of the race. Came down to my dad's last pit board at the Craig. It said P7. I went, oh, we're happy with that. That's my top 10. It's good. So just rode it round in over the line, back up the return road. helmet off. And again, I think it must have been my sister again. It was either my sister or our last Fiona. She came over to me and she said, "You've just set the fastest lap of the race." And I looked at it, I looked again. It was the same look I gave him when I won the race. So he went, "You what?" I was like, "Not a chance." And they're like, "Yeah, you've on the last lap, you've just set the fastest lap of the race." And then someone else came on and said, "Yeah, and that because it's a super twin race, like that's the super twin lap record around here." And I'm like, I was like, absolutely. And they said, "Oh, and you've got P6. You'd gained another place between like the bungalow and the finish line." I was like, "Wow, I couldn't believe it."
So, straight to McDonald's.
Yeah, no, not to McDonald's. Port Jack again for a chippy. That's probably more likely. But it was just, yeah, it was another unbelievable moment. Again, at that point, my Manx Grand Prix, I could have left the island happy.
That's amazing, isn't it? And I think I remember that because I spoke to you, I think, after that race, and we didn't know at that point that you'd set that record. Mm. But it would have been great to get that reaction from you. But yeah, and I guess then the question now, as we're sitting here talking in the sort of second week or so of November, is all attention looks to 2026. Have you sorted out what you're doing next year yet?
Well, me and Nick have made a few little plans. We got back the second race on the Super Twin didn't go as well. We just about got up to third at Balaff Bridge, so we're running third, and then unfortunately the engine blew up going into Parliament Square at Ramsey. So we were asking a lot of the engine. All I got told before the race was just give it hell and it'll either last or it won't, and unfortunately it didn't. So we got back after the Manx Grand Prix this year, and we said we're gonna retire that Super Twin. I think we've done everything that it's reached the limits of its development now. Probably asked a lot trying to drag me around, or me try and get it round any faster than what it has. 115.6 mile an hour was the lap that we did on it. So I was, and I came in and said to Nick, I said, "It's got more in it." And he said, "I don't know if my wallet's got more though, with the amount of engines that we're getting through." So yeah, we made a plan. We've already said we're going to come back next year. He's got a 636 Kawasaki, and we're going to come back and do the Super Sport and Senior Manx Grand Prix. That's set in stone as a plan. We're going to do the same as we did this year in 24, make sure we have a proper testing schedule, get me up to speed on the bike, comfortable on the bike before we head off down Bray Hill. But the Super Twin side of things was still unknown, to be honest. It feels like I'm a bit of a broken record going into the winter again, putting that plea out there for someone to just sort of offer a bike for me to race next year at the Manx Grand Prix. I've got the word of Nick. He said he'd happily run the bike. He said he can't afford to actually finance a bike, because again, he's just a little bike shop in Scarborough. He's just doing it for the love of it. He absolutely loves everything he does, and he put everything into me this year, and I put everything I had into it this year. That's 2 years in a row that my credit cards actually wept a tear at the end of August. So it's there's a lot of money goes into it all. So yeah, I feel like I'm coming into the winter again with I've got a good plan of what I'm going to do next year with one bike. But again, the Super Twin side of things, I don't want to let that go by the wayside, because I feel like I've got a little bit of unfinished business coming into 2026. It'll be with the lap record, and I feel like there's more to come from that there.
So you need to be somewhere giving a speech where the right people are in the room again.
Yeah, I just need to get into the right room and say the right things at the right time, to be honest. I am a massive believer that everything happens for a reason and things do fall into place. But again, if you don't voice what you actually want to achieve in life, how does anyone know what you want to do? So you need to be in that room in the right place, telling people what you want to do, without me standing up on stage with a microphone and telling people that I wanted to race a Super Twin at the Manx Grand Prix in 2025. I won't be sat here now saying that I'd got that lap record and we'd had such a great event.
I tell you, if you're driving any coaches, get that microphone on and start speaking. You never know.
Yeah,
you're
going to
be faring round.
Yeah, there could be just the right person sat behind me. You never know.
Obviously, being out there on social media is a crucial part of being a racer nowadays. Where can people find you, Harley?
The best place to follow me on social media is Harley Rushton Racing on Facebook, to be honest. I've tried doing all the video logs and everything else, but between working, spannering the bikes and everything else that goes on, I really struggle with the editing time. Thankfully, I think I've got someone next year who's going to do a bit of video editing for me. So all I have to do is the filming side of things. People in the paddock will know that I'm a little bit of a character, and I like doing some outrageous things. And if I can get that on film, I'm pretty sure people would
How outrageous are we talking?
I think my sister got on video this year at the Manx. I needed a hammer to go and put some tent pegs in for the awning. So I was riding across the paddock topless with a hammer looking like the hammer of Thor. His sister said, "That is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. You're on a monkey bike riding across the paddock, topless, with a hammer in your hand."
Right, so, it's quite an image there, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite an image, that. And I've got to say, me pit crew are just... can be just as mad. Before the race, we loaded up the tins of fuel on an electric e-scooter to go and take up into pit lane. I looked at it and went, "That's not going to work." And he just looked at me and said, "Don't you worry." That's what Tommy said. He said, "Don't you worry. Leave it to me." And he set off across the paddock with these two drums of fuel on an electric scooter. And I said, "Lithium batteries have a habit of setting on fire. That's not a good thing to have all that fuel set on top of it."
But it was fine.
It's fine.
It's all fine.
Yeah, we don't worry about things like
probably
that.
Don't try that if you are listening and wondering how you're going to transport your fuel next year. How is Christmas 2025 looking for you? Have you got a big family one planned?
I haven't actually got to Christmas planning yet. Everyone says, "What are you doing next week?" And I said, "I don't know. I haven't got that far. I worry about racing first, and then everything else comes separately." We always go down to London. We have some family down there, so we're going to do a bit of a family gathering down in London, have an early Christmas dinner. Anyone who knows me well knows that my favourite meal is a roast. Even though the chip thing has come up a lot, I do like a chippy, but a roast dinner is potentially my favourite meal. So the more Christmas dinners I can have, the better.
Followed by some biscuits, yeah?
No, pudding and sponge and custard. Jam roly poly and custard is a top-tier favourite of mine.
Okay. So you're not a Christmas pudding fan then?
No, I don't like Christmas pudding. No. Don't like mince pies either.
Really? Yeah, I know. Okay.
But my sister and dad love that because I never steal their mince pies or Christmas pudding, so they're more than happy that I don't like them.
Everybody's a winner. Just finally, Harley, I wanted to ask you, for anybody who might be listening and waiting to see whether or not they have an entry for next year's MGP, what would be the one thing that you wish you'd known at that point before you knew you had that entry?
That's a tough question, that. One thing I'd wish I'd known. Doesn't matter how much you think it won't consume your entire life, believe me, it consumes your entire life for 3 to 4 months around the Manx Grand Prix in August. I thought, I've got the right people alongside me, I've got the bikes there, they're all built, ready to go. And I went, "It'd be fine." People said, "No, your world will become the Manx Grand Prix in the Isle of Man." And I'm like, "No, it won't. Trust me, it does."
But here you are again.
Here we are again, going through it all. All the sacrifices that are made, and you get home and your house is an absolute tip, and it's just like the piles of riding gear in one corner and race parts in another corner, and you go, "Maybe I should sort of start thinking about tidying the house up a bit." But it just totally involves you, and you're just bouncing from sorting out one thing for going racing to sorting out another thing, and your spare time in the house is literally just spent sleeping.
Harley, it's been great talking to you. Thank you very much for coming in. I understand you might have an extra day over here because the weather, as gorgeous as it is, if we look across Douglas Bay at the moment, it's set to be a bit rubbish tomorrow.
Yeah, it's coming in a bit rubbish. So, you might be stuck with me over here for another day, which I don't mind. I can go around and do some extra laps in the van and see if I can pick up any more pointers around the course.
Harley, it's been great talking to you. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much, Beth. Cheers.
Harley Rushton. And I'm very pleased to say he did actually get away. The boat did sail this morning, but if you look out of the window now, there's no way it's coming back from Heysham. As ever, all the links to Harley's social media are on the podcast page, so do give him a follow and find out what he is going to do in 2026. Thank you so much for downloading this episode. If you'd like to be part of the podcast in the future, just drop me an email, bethesby@manxradio.com. And until next time, take care. Bye-bye.